Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel's
feeding it! Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Hi again, everybody. Jungle Jim Jerome coming at you with Rusty Cortinel. We live to breathe another week, Rusty, with the Suspendables. And we've had a great couple years doing this. And favorite part of the shows are when we bring on guests. Okay.
You bet.
Favorite part of the shows are when we bring on guests with people I absolutely love. Okay. We have history. Okay.
Do we ever?
I'm going to read you some stats, Kenny. I'm going to read you some stats about you. But my favorite time, I first moved to Edmonton in 1985. Kenny, born in Windsor, but grew up here. And that was the start of his career, was in 82. Rusty.
It went downhill from there.
Yeah. And that was in the days when New Jersey wasn't quite winning cups. So Kenny was back early, you know, in April. And of course we hung around with the Oilers. Kenny has a great connection with the Messier family and a bunch of other guys. And so Kenny and I became thick as thieves. Okay, Rusty, celebrating each and every victory every night. Okay. Downtown. And my favorite part, Kenny, was everyone wanted to go home at 3 a.m. after they won this cup, right? And you and I said, excuse my language, I said, no, fuck that, man. We're not going home. And me and Paul Messier, to make a long story short, 5 hours later at 8 a.m., Paul Messier was driving down Jasper Avenue and he stopped and picked up me and Kenny as we were walking down in ponchos and sombreros walking down Jasper Avenue.
Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, back then. How about this? Drafted in 1982, retired quickly, if we move it, retired in 2003, 20 plus years as a pro hockey player and played for the same team. Okay. Unheard of.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Doing that. But the real stat I want to hear about, I was looking at Wikipedia. Kenny, you got your chiclets blasted out. It said, okay.
But yeah, they're looking good right now, aren't they, Jim? All
they're strong, baby.
They look perfect.
Those are strong. But I found out, Kenny, apparently Russ knocked out your chiclets during a game. Our guest is one of the most successful careers in the NHL, Kenny Danico. How are you, Kenny?
What's up, Jimmy? But you went right to Russ. I think it was Jeff knocked out a few.
No, it was me, because when your teeth were laying on the ice and you were bleeding, I was shitting my pants when you were chasing me all over Jersey.
It's so funny, Russ, because when I was coming on with you guys, I'm glad to be on with you, man. And Jimmy, yes, we go way, way, way back. And you've probably got a way better memory than me, Jim. We have a blast back then. I just can't remember a lot of it. So you're going to, I'm sure, remind me a little bit some of the crazy stuff we did. I was coming on, and that when I knew I was coming on with Russ, I go, oh, I can't wait to tell him the story about Jeff knocking out my chiclets and me chasing him around the ice and foaming from the mouth. But in fact, it was you, Russ. You got a few in the bottom, I think, where the stick swung around. I don't know if it was inadvertent or not. I wasn't happy. I know that.
So, Jimmy, I'll tell you what happened, because I'll never forget. So I was going wide on you to go in behind the net to try and hit Scott Stevens, and you gave me just a little cross check in the bottom of my pants, and I lost control, hit Scott Stevens, fell on the ice, and as I fell back, I hit you in the face with my stick.
Right the heel, the hard part of the blade.
Oh, my God.
That's one of the things I do remember. It was the bottom teeth and, oh, my God. And I, Jim, I had a tendency, old school, I didn't go down. I was angry. I was extremely angry. But now that I look at it, it's all said and done, Russ. You did me a favor, because now I have these beautiful implants. I didn't want a few, normal teeth or natural teeth at the end of the day. I got them all fixed and unofficially, officially, I know everybody thinks Bobby Clark. I think I, at the end of my career, I officially had the most teeth missing. It was six up top, seven on the bottom, but I got pearly new whites over the years.
I felt horrible, and I was not that kind of player. I don't even know if I ever knocked anybody else's teeth out. But Kenny, when you were done chasing after me and the referees all caught between you and me, and you were spitting blood and screaming and yelling, and you were obviously in pain and pissed off. You wanted to fucking kill me. I totally understood. But here's what happened. I go to the bench, and I always sat on the bench with my stick blades sticking up, not on the ground. And I looked, and I had a wooden Sherwood, and it was like you took the heel of my stick and tried to bite it. You had all your teeth marks were in the bottom of my stick, and I was like, "Oh my god!" The rest of the game, and you never missed a freaking shift. And the next shift, you came, and I kept telling you, Kenny, it was an accident. It was an accident, I swear. And you're like, I'm going to fucking kill you. I'm not going to catch you. I'm going to fucking kill you.
The good old days. We were a different breed back then, yes, Russ. But like I said, at the end of the day, you did me a favor. Good now, all forgiven. What, 30-something years?
Yeah, later. Yeah. When Jimmy said we were going to bring you on, I said, "Well, thank God he's in Jersey and I'm in L.A."
I was hoping you were in L.A. and then you could go to Russ's house and knock out his front freaking teeth. Just to repay.
I am a kinder, gentler soul these days. I look back and you know, all kidding aside. And think about some of those, whether it's crazy times on the ice, off the ice, and it just seems like a whole nother world, like from so far back. It's hard to really understand that that was the way I was and all of us were. We were so different, whether it was on the ice. And yeah, I was an extremely intense player. I had to play that way. That was my role. And even on stuff off the ice. And like I said, I've gotten a lot softer over the years, guys. So no, and like I said, no question, Russ did me a favor because I got nice than I would have had if they weren't knocked out.
Yeah. You've got these unbelievable stats, Kenny, in your career. Like,
well, certainly not a lot of goals.
No, well, I didn't know. I had a question mark whether to bring this up because I didn't want you to knock out my teeth.
Okay.
There's a great line in Wikipedia what it says about you, and they talk about the 2,200 penalty minutes.
That's wrong, by the way.
Oh, okay.
It's 2,500. Oh, so I always clarify it. Some guys say 22. It's 25 and change, but, you know, who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? Yeah, yeah. And the other big one, 255 consecutive games that you played is just, I mean, that's just remarkable in terms of, you know, trying to play in the NHL. The other thing it said, I'm trying to think, what's that expression that makes separates you and Kenny? Oh yeah, he has Stanley Cups, Russ. Yeah,
okay. Oh, here we go.
I put one on for you guys right here.
Nice. Right? Nice. That's nice. What that looks like. Yeah.
See that, Russ? Yeah. One of the lines is there, you know, they're talking about all your stats and then they go into six seasons without scoring a goal.
No, but it's only three full seasons. That was near the end of my career.
So everyone's lying.
Well, it was a record, like 200 and something games. But I always tell people, look, offensive linemen, how many touchdowns do they score?
Attaboy.
I mean, I was like an offensive lineman. Everybody has a role, man. Lou Lamoriello used to put a dog collar on me once he got here. Early in my career, I was scoring 5-6 a year. Hell, in juniors and Kamloops, and I came back from the NHL after breaking my leg. I had 34 points in 19 games. People don't realize every kid coming out of junior was a scorer, including me, because I was bigger, stronger, faster than. When you get to the National Hockey League, you have to find a role that is going to make you stick.
That's right.
I'm grateful I found a role that was going to make me stick. But Lou used to take me in. I mean, look, we always want to score. If we score, it's a bonus, of course. But early on, I'd get a few points and a few goals along the way. And I'll tell you a great story, and I've told this a million times, but I'll elaborate a little on it. Jim alluded to you talking about, I still hold that record. I think it was 256 straight games without scoring a goal. And then imagine the guy I scored on who's in the media now, Marty Baron. And every time I'm on SiriusXM, I bring it up to Marty. And by the way, the goal was looked like I was a 50-goal scorer because it was an absolute blast from the point. So we're all capable, but I understood my role. Lou didn't care if I ever scored a goal. So early in my career, when Lou Lamoriello, the great Hall of Fame general manager and the architect of those Devils championships, came, it was about the first year he was here. And I was getting a little second power play time, believe it or not, because Bruce Driver was injured. And he was our power play, second power play unit guy. Well, Bruce is out 4 games. I have 4 points in 4 games, not a word of a lie. Doing pretty well. And I wore my emotion on my sleeve, and Bruce comes back, I'm getting no power play time. So I'm disgruntled. And in practice, I'm bitching, I'm moaning. I'm, you know, one of those 23-year-old kids that's just, you know, up in arms, because we always want to be jack of all trades, maybe master of none. But I was one of those guys, you always want to do more, right? And I thought I was capable. And Lou goes after practice, Kenny, come to my office. Something's bothering you. And he knew exactly what was bothering me. So he just had the pulse on the team and me. And so he goes, what's bothering you? Even though he knew. I go, well, Lou, you know, I had, you know, pretty good success in the second power play unit, 4 points in 4 games, and now I'm not on the power play. He goes, sit down, Kenny. He says, I liken my team to an orchestra. He says, there's pianists, there's violinists, and there's drummers. What category do you think you fall in there? Now, I'm not the point to fall on the tree, but I know where he's headed. And I know he's saying, I'm a drummer. And he goes, in order to make beautiful music, everybody has to play that instrument to a T. And he goes, I don't care if you ever score a goal again. He says, you kill penalties, you protect teammates, you play tough, you block shots. That is your role on this team. So I get up, and I was one of the rare guys. Lou's a very intimidating man, and you didn't want to go to his office too often, and I went plenty for some off-ice antics too, but this was early. I was a kid that would give it back. And I got up, threw the chair in his office, and he's sitting calmly with his arms crossed. He looked like he was going to jump on his desk, you know, and come after me. He was kind of like a Wolverine or a pit bull. And I throw the chair, and he's just kind of watching this, and I'm ready to walk out the door. And he goes, oh yeah, Kenny, by the way, he says, if you master that drum, you're going to play in this league 15 years. If you don't and you want to be a violinist, I'll call 15 other teams and see if they need a violinist. God's honest truth, I slam the door, take it to heart. I'm frustrated because, like I said, all of us, it's yeah, but, trying to plead your case. And I took it to heart. And I said, you know what? He's right. I got a role. Do it to a T, and maybe I'll stick around for a little while. And sure enough, when I retired in 2003 and we had a little press conference, I turned to Lou right away and said, Lou, just to piss you off, I played 20 years. So, and he knew exactly what I was saying, because he says I could play 15 years. But, you know, and it's a funny story. It's a heartfelt story. It's verbatim, and Lou still gives this story to young players in the island. He's told me, he's asked me, do you mind if I use the story with you? I says, I use it so often, Kenny, and I know the game's evolved and changed and everything else, but he says, players that don't understand the role find themselves out of league. And if I didn't listen to him, like I said, I took it to heart and I listened. And there were so many, and Russ, I'm sure you could see so many players that were so much more talented or better skilled, or guys we played junior against, or a guy that had a cup of coffee in the NHL, were so focused on our own careers that I go, where did that guy go? How's he out of the league? And he was great in junior, or he had a flash of 10 games where he's great, but he couldn't find that role or translate his game from junior or college to the National Hockey League to the extent that we think we're capable of. And understanding a role was the greatest lesson I learned from Lou, that, yeah, I can find a role here. I can be part of successful team. We weren't very good early on. When Luke came, that changed. And like you mentioned, Jimmy, we were bad at the start, but it was that much more gratifying to be part of the solution and just play my little part, man. And I was fortunate that I had a general manager that gave me that speech at a young age, because if I was trying to do too much every night, it would take away from what I'm better at, and that's PK and defensively and shutting right. down some top players when I can. I would have been out of the league. He's absolutely right. I probably would have played 5 years.
Yeah, the best line I read from this thing, Kenny, was he wasn't paid for putting pucks in the net, but he sure made his money keeping pucks out of the net.
Playing against Jersey, I mean, if you could get by Kenny and Scott and the other D-men that they had, and they had some other really good defensemen, but if you could get by them, then you had to try to score on Brodeur. And you guys were so good. And I played in Montreal for 4 years, and we were defensive minded, very similar to the way Jersey played. And I think actually Jersey took Montreal's playbook and really mastered it.
Because we had Lemaire and Robinson come to us and implement that kind of structure and system, and defense wins championships. But Russ, I will say, and Jimmy, quickly, that it does, I don't know why, after all these years, and I'm very grateful and fortunate to win Stanley Cup, still irks me a little bit when people say, oh, it was boring, or they played a trap, or whatever it may have been. I never heard the word trap from Jacques Lemaire once. It was responsible hockey. It takes away from how good our forwards are. If you look, and nobody in the Canadian media over the years, or in the media hockey world and media in general, when they were saying we were boring the game down and it's not good for hockey at times, we were always one of the top scoring teams in the National Hockey League. If you look at it, it's right there in blueprint 94 when we lost to the Rangers before we won our Stanley Cup in 95 in the Eastern Conference Finals. We were the number two team to the New York Rangers in goals for in the National Hockey League. 2000, we won the Cup. We were number two in the National Hockey League in goals for. And 2001, when we lost to the Colorado Avalanche, we were number one in the regular season in goals for. How boring is that? So they were acting like we were just lining up guys and weren't scoring. We just had a balanced attack. It wasn't about 250 goal scorers. Everybody scored. Everybody contributed. Yeah. And nobody ever, that's still to this day never brought up. When the LA Kings won the Stanley Cup in 2012, they were the lowest scoring team in the National Hockey League. I never heard once that they're playing a boring defensive style and Jonathan Quick's standing on his head. So I still don't get it, because we scored.
And Kenny, my best years were playing that style hockey that you guys played for Montreal and Minnesota and Dallas. Mm. My best offensive years were when I personally focused more on the defensive side of the puck. And when you play good defense, you get tons of scoring chances.
Funny how that works, right, Russ?
Yeah, I played on a line with Guy Carboneau and Mike McPhee in Montreal. And then in
great players.
Minnesota, Dallas, I got to play with Neil Broughton, who you won a cup with, who was a 100-plus point centerman who got converted to playing a defensive side of the puck. And that's when I had my best years with those guys. So I agree with you 100%, but the media just hammered us. And crazy. Yeah, there was the odd game where it was boring.
Right.
I think we played you guys to a 0-0 tie in Montreal and our fans booed us.
well, you know what? What people don't realize, Russ, that comes from the 70s Canadians, where we think they were the flying Frenchmen. That's Jacques Lemaire, Larry Ross, all those greats implementing a system, a belief, and how you're going to win cups. And, you know, if you even look at Jimmy, I mean, the Oilers were a little bit of an anomaly, but once they finally were able to get over that hump and win all those cups, because, yeah, they had so many Hall of Famers and skilled offensive guys. But if you ask Messier and Gretzky and these guys, they're going to say, well, we started to play better defensively in front of Grant Fuhr, not just exchange chances every night to go four grueling rounds and win championships along the way. And you mentioned Neil Broughton, Russ. Well, ironically, he came to us later in his career in 95. Without Neil Broughton, we don't win the cup. But he was more of a, you're absolutely right, a responsible 200-foot player. But he had more points in the playoffs that year, maybe than any of his playoff years. He was so instrumental for us, scored so many key goals because of exactly what you were talking about,
And he took your spot on the power play on the point. He took
my spot on the power play.
I said, Rusty, when I was loving the idea when we lined up Kenny to come on, and when I was sitting down here about half an hour before the show started, I said, I hope he's not too shy, and I hope Kenny has something to say, you know, because it could be.
Kenny, you know me better than that, man.
Yeah, I know, man. How did you do it, Kenny? How did you play? Like, I hear, you know, when guys retire and they go like this, incredible, should be in the Hall of Fame. The guy played 12 years, played 9 years in the NHL. How did you do it, Kenny? How did you, as a fighter, as, you know, with injuries? I mean, I think I read that you cracked your tibia or your fibula, right? In your first game or something. You had numerous injuries, and yet you lasted that long. What was the secret to that, Danico?
Just the love for the game and the passion, Jim, and it was all about winning for me. I just wanted to be part of a winning organization, and I was very grateful, fortunate to play with great guys and great teammates. And I don't just say that to say it. I mean, we had such a core group that you just never wanted to let anybody down. And frankly, I always tell, you know, now at times maybe guys don't play through as much. It's a different mentality. I love the skill, and I do the Devils games, and I do NHL Network and stuff. And I've gone with the times. I mean, I don't need to see the fighting anymore. Like I said, I've gotten softer, and I like the skill level and the speed of the game. Our era was our era. It was fun. I enjoyed it, but it was nasty. But when people try to compare or say, can you play in this era? It's like comparing apples to oranges. That's just the way you train back then. Technology nowadays with skates and sticks and everything being lighter. These guys train at young ages and as kids, more about puck hunting. For us, we had to get our foot in the door being big, physical for the most part. So I digress a little bit, but I say the people I would have trained differently. I had to train like a middle linebacker because I knew how I was getting my foot in the door. I had some skill as a young player from an offensive standpoint, like I talked about. But how I played, I just, Jimmy, I'm amazed by it. And believe me, everybody knows it's well documented. I like to live life. I had fun. I parted my you-know-what off, and I've come full circle with that. And
right.
I don't drink anymore, and I'm proud of that, and I haven't in a lot of years. And I bring it up because any person or kid I can help along the way through my experiences that they don't maybe have to go through, I love that. But man, I just had a passion for the game. The Devils were like family to me. They put up with the thick, they put up with the ups and downs on and off the ice with me. They believed in me, and I just was going to play as hard as I could every night and battle through whatever it was, and just hope they didn't take me out of the lineup or trade me.
Right. Did you the other fact, Kenny, you might have lost is because you got 44-inch biceps. Okay, that might be this guy's got fucking volleyballs, man, in his arms. I remember that.
I burnt the candle at both ends, as you know, Jimmy. I've trained extremely hard. Like, people think, well, he likes to have fun, he's crazy. And the officers, I train like a maniac. You know that. And I always say, we joke about the arms, even with Niedermeyer, Stevens, and I'm still very close with Niedermeyer. And I go, guys, I don't even have to work out now. I'm 57 years old. I've had these pythons since sixth grade. So that was my attribute. That was my thing. And so many of my teammates, Billy Guerin, who's GM in Minnesota, who I just loved. He was a young buck, a rookie when we won our first cup, and so instrumental in 95. We had a great mix of young and old and veterans and middle-aged guys. And I had him on NHL Network the other day, and he goes, Kenny, I still tell people the story of every single time you got a penalty, you said to the ref, he says, that's not a penalty. That's just 2 minutes for being too strong. And Billy still says he tells everybody he loves it. And that was me. I was a nut. I was a character. But I did try to keep the room loose, that's for sure. I remember Carey Fraser. I ran into him a few years ago, and he's still laughing about it because I think he was the first ref I said it to. And he says, his jaw dropped. He didn't know what to say to me. Because I got a penalty in front knocking a guy down. And I says, are you crazy? That's just being way too strong. You're going to call me for that?
That's awesome.
Was there ever a point, Kenny, in your career, if you can bring us inside a bit, that maybe you might have got traded. You were looking at a trade, or was it always going to be you were going to be a New Jersey Devil till the day you retired? Talk about that. Was there a time you're going, okay, I want out here? I mean, there were some tough times with New Jersey along the way.
No. First and foremost, when I was drafted, again, a lot of these stories are well documented, but maybe not to your audience. So when I was drafted in 1982, I get a phone call bright and early, and I went out for a few pops with my brother the night before as an 18-year-old to kind of ease the tension, because you're all anxious, all us young guys. And Russ, you know, you've been through that. And I'm going, I think I'm going to get drafted. I'm just not sure where and how high. And In fact, I think I was ranked around the third round. And now it's not that nowadays they can look up anything. They know when you eat, when you sleep, what you drink, when you go to the bathroom. You know, back then, you relied on one scout to follow you around. But I'd heard I was ranked late second round, maybe third round. But I was cautiously optimistic. But if I went in the third round, I was going to be elated. So I did a call. The draft was in Montreal. I'm in Edmonton, 2-hour time difference earlier. I'm a little groggy. My mother, my late mother, petite little lady, you know, she knew. I told her every day, 10 times a day, I'm going to play in the National Hockey League from 7 years old on. Not a word of a lie. Every day, 10 times a day, she used to pacify me and go, yeah. I know. And she used to go to my dad, who's 91 and still living in Edmonton. And she'd always go, you know, I don't know if he's being realistic. I mean, this damn hockey dream of his is pretty asinine. And my dad said, it was a quiet man, quiet old German man would say, well, let him believe, Ollie, let him believe, you know, I mean, we'll see when the time comes. So sure enough, I'm 18. I get the call. My mother walks upstairs. Kenny, come down, take this call. It was about 35 minutes into the draft. I look at the clock, groggy. Had a few pops, like I said, night before. I go, Mom, it's way too early. It's one of my friends playing a prank. It's a huge.
Yeah.
And when she wanted my attention, she says, Kenneth, come down and take this call. So I go downstairs. I go, hello. You know, they go, Ken, congratulations. This is Marshall Johnson. We have just taken you 18th overall. And I dropped the phone. I dropped the phone, you know, in tears. I know a lot of kids react like this, but I was just beside myself over the
wow.
I turned to my mother and I said, you're not going to believe this. I was just drafted 18th. She goes, my mother, who's never swore, goes, you've got to be effing kidding me. I swear she never had swore in her life. She goes, pick it up. Ask who it is. I didn't ask what team it was. I didn't even give a crap. I didn't care where it was. I picked it up, and that was my mentality. I picked up, oh, yeah, who is this? It's Marshall Johnson. This is New Jersey. They didn't have a team name yet. They just moved from Colorado. They were picking it in the newspaper, in the Newark Star-Ledger, so there was no team yet. And I turned to my mother. I covered the phone, and not a word of a lie, said, Mom, where's New Jersey? I knew it was near the big city somewhere, but I had no idea really where New Jersey was. I would have ran the 2,000 miles to get my opportunity. And again, I elaborated, Jim, and that's what I do. But no.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
I had a shiver there.
That team was going to give me my opportunity, my dream. First step was getting drafted. Second step was trying to play a game in the league. And this was the team giving me a chance. And it was one scout, Bert Marshall, that I understand, and Russ, you probably have these kinds of stories, but apparently he drove around in an old Winnebago for about 2 weeks just to watch me. And that was an important draft. New Jersey's first draft. They had two picks in the first round, 8 and 18th. Well, he comes back to New Jersey. He tells him, if Ken Danico's there at 18, I'm telling you, you take him. I know his character, his heart. Watch me in the playoffs. And New Jersey, everybody, the brass, true story, is going to him. Bert, he's not ranked there. We don't know enough about him. We're not going to take him there. Bert goes, I'm telling you, take the goddamn guy at 18. So apparently, and if this is true, and I hear it, and I saw Bert Marshall in 2012, and he elaborated on it, so apparently it's true. He goes, Kenny, you don't know. They told me my job is on the line. Scouts put their job on the line.
Bert, yeah, they do.
He said, I'll put my job on the line. This kid will play 10 plus years for you. And so they went with him, picked me 18th. They took Rocky Trache, who I love, Brian's brother, number 8. He played 25 games. I played 1,283 and 175 more in the playoffs. And I don't say that gloating or being arrogant. I say it humbly that I can't believe it. They couldn't believe it. Nobody really could, but one man put faith and trust in me watching me play, and one guy that believed in me, and I wasn't going to let them down or him down.
That's fuck, awesome. I feel like I'm listening to Tony Robbins. Yeah, I'm fucking, no kidding. I'm so this pumped awesome. Up right now. So, I'm like,
you want to go one better, Jimmy, or I'll keep going on this. You guys don't even
absolutely.
Have questions. I'll just ramble and I get fired up about it because, you know, there's a great memories and stories. So, you know, Mess and me and, sure. and you, and we all hung out together. And, you know, Mark, I always say, and his brother, Paul, I always say, we're such huge mentors of mine. I looked up to them so much. And you know that. You saw me. I was like a little puppy dog around those guys. Hey, I wouldn't touch the cup when they were winning it.
You were tripping over Jimmy if you were running around like a puppy dog.
Well, me and Jimmy were hugging and drinking and celebrating.
Exactly.
But I couldn't take pictures with it. I was just trying to get my foot in the door, and I just get drafted. But, you know, Mark always treated me with the utmost respect, and Kevin Lowe and Coffee and all those guys and Gretz and certainly Paul, his brother. But so apparently, because Sather became the general manager of the Rangers late in my career. In 2006, I'm walking up the ramp, Madison Square Garden, and Sather goes to me, 3 years after my career is over, congratulations, Kenny, great career, you know, because I met him through Mark over the years, and obviously you know each other a little bit. He goes, thank God New Jersey took you at 18. Obviously, I made a mistake because the defenseman I drafted played about 25 games too. or he would have made a mistake because they got 20th pick. The Islanders 21. It was only 21 teams. He goes, because Mark told me if I was available, you take this kid at 20. And that's another apparent true story. And Sailor says, thank God, because Mark would have never forgave me. I was kind of real happy when New Jersey took you. And I said, he goes, and it worked out pretty well for you. And I said, I didn't want to come to you guys. I never would have made your lineup. You know?
So, funny how things work out.
And we got a little chuckle out of that. But yeah, Mark was telling him, yeah, I think you got to take this kid. I've known him since 10 years old. And trust me, he'll play for us. You know. Yeah. So, but it all worked out. And I know. Did I want to be traded? Never. I wanted to be part of the solution. I wanted to go through those tough years and be part of something that building from the ground up. And I always believed in my heart we were going to turn the corner. And we were winning 17 games a year. First few years I'd played, and everybody says, you guys are terrible. You suck. And I'm like one of those guys going, you wait and see. We're going to be a contender one day. And they'd laugh at me and chuckle at me. And I'm just grateful Lou Lamoriello didn't trade me. I heard a rumor one time in the Post that I was going to get traded to the Calgary Flames. And apparently, you know, when all these rumors start, and I went right into Lou's office. Are you trading me to Calgary? And I said, because you know I don't want to go anywhere. He says, Kenny, don't listen to that nonsense. And he taught me not to listen to the rumors, but I just didn't want to go anywhere. They gave me my shot. And lo and behold, I've been here 40 years, and they have treated me like family, like gold, whether as a player or in the organization, 41 years.
That's amazing.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And still, whether it be in the community, whether in the broadcast, whatever they've asked me to do, I'll do, because they have treated me like gold, and I couldn't be – I'm the luckiest guy in the world from that standpoint.
Hey, Kenny, during – you're talking about the getting the phone call during the draft, your mom answered the phone, and I can totally understand why you thought it was a joke, because they usually, Jimmy, they fly in
right.
all yes. the first round picks. And so they're all there, and it's really sad to watch the guys who don't get picked.
It's awful.
They're up in the stands. They don't get picked. They get, you know, second, third round. They're supposed to go in the first. So everybody who's supposed to go in the first round is there. And I can totally understand why Kenny thought it was a joke. Well, Kenny, one year during the draft, my brother's the biggest fucking prankster on the planet.
Yes, I heard that.
So I'm in Toronto, and he's in Victoria washing our boat that we bought when we both made the NHL, and he's out washing the boat, and the draft's on. So I call my mom's number, and she answers, hi. And I go, hi, this is Phil Esposito from the New York Rangers. Could I talk to Jeff Courtnell? And she goes to the back porch, Jeff, Jeff, it's Phil Esposito from the New York Rangers. And I can hear him running up the stairs. Who is it? She goes, Phil Esposito. He goes, hello. And I put on this accent. I go, hey, it's Phil Esposito from the New York Rangers. Welcome to the team. And he goes, what? What the fuck? What? We just traded for you. What? And I go, I started laughing. And Jeff goes, you fucking asshole. If you were in Toronto, I'd fucking kill you right now. That's the worst thing you've ever done to me.
He bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Oh, hook, line, and sinker.
That is awful. That's awful to
you
do.
You know what? You mentioned that first round thing, Russ, and it's a good memory because my agent at the time was Bill Waters. And
oh, sure.
Exactly. Yeah,
so mine too.
He was on the radio with Sirius, and about 5 years ago, give or take, whatever, I get on the on their show, and I love Bill, and it was great. Well, anyway, I ended up letting him go about 3 years later, and I said, Bill, you know why I let you go, right? Because you didn't have any faith in me. You never flew me to the draft. You didn't think I was going in the first round. And Bill, he's such a great sport. He goes, well, I wasn't going to waste the money. I didn't think you'd first round. Yeah, it cost you a client. Yeah. I didn't think I was going in the first round, but you're not supposed to think that.
Yeah. This is too much, man. This could be our last show, Rusty. Let's go out on a high, man.
Hey, Bill was my agent too. And he brought in John McClain. So in the first round, he had, John McClain, myself, Jeff Jackson went in the second round. He had brought in Dan Hodgson, who went later. He had Gerald Diddick and another guy went to Pittsburgh who does the play by play. But
Bobby Urey.
Yeah. So we're there together. And Jimmy, the agent flies you in, they give you the credit card, you go out on the town, buy all kinds of drinks. Dinner. Everybody talks about it when you go to the draft. Oh, your agent's going to give you the credit card. So we get the credit card. We go. John McClain is my roommate. He gets drafted to New Jersey, I think sixth overall.
Sixth overall, yeah.
And I went I went right after him, but we're roommates and we get back after this night of the credit card and we want to order pizza. So John goes, I'm going to order the pizza. I wake up in the morning and he's asleep with the phone on his ear. He passed out with the phone on his ear, freaking ordering pizza. Oh,
I'm not sure. The landscape's changed a little bit since then, Jim and Russ. I would believe you. Well, they hand them a boat or a car now, but they didn't allow you to have the same kind of fun. They don't allow you to have the same kind of fun that we did back then.
No way.
Kenny, what was your... two questions. What was your contract and what did you splurge on I forget what you told us you bought when you first signed your contract.
I think I went 18th overall. I think I got 20,000 the first year and 20,000 the second year as a signing bonus. Russ and Johnny Mac, I'm sure got closer to 80 or 100, but because it was always kind of right slotted. And I think my first year was 80, 90, 100, a three-year deal, 100 grand. Yeah. Isn't it amazing? Doesn't sound like a lot, but it seemed like billions to us back then. And my first thing was a car, and it turned out to be a lemon. I got a 318i BMW. I thought I was the coolest guy in the world. And they recalled them about 6 months later. And I've had BMWs since after that, and I love them. But no, it was a lemon at the time. But my dad, oh, this is great. So my dad goes to me. So I tell my dad, I said, I just bought this car, Dad. And you know, my dad, like I said, just an old school guy and very simplistic, but practical. I go, Dad, I got this car. I got a great deal on it, a new car, and with my signing bonus. He goes, well, maybe, and then he found out it, you know, wasn't running very well. And he goes, your problem, Kenny, was you forgot to ask who the good deal was for them or you. And I took that to heart, and that was a good lesson. My dad says, it's never what it seems. Anytime they're telling you, you're getting a good deal.
What was the... like the length of time, I keep going back to it because it's incredible, you know, that playing 20 years. And by the way, You may have a record for a broadcast career too. I mean, that career is like walking in the door every day going, am I going to get fired? Am I going to get let go?
Well, I'm fortunate. Like I said, unless I absolutely butcher it, I get an opportunity with the Devils because of the loyalty they've shown me and the loyalty I've shown them. And I'm very grateful for that.
What was your, speaking of broadcasting, when I started doing it, the radio show, because I think we had you on back when in my Ottawa days, I remember going to break and thinking my mic was off.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, not good. What's the toughest part about it, Kenny? You're going to advise all these young kids coming in. Yes, it's different. Russ always makes a great point, though, sometimes, you know, when they go, Russ, if you got to play now, compared to when you did. And Russ, you've always said, I'll tell you what, the guys who were great players back then would be great players today. The best players back then would still be the best. If you're advising young guys, Kenny, what did you find was the toughest part about being an NHL player and playing pro?
Oh, gosh.
Catching the 6 a.m. bus the night after a game in Calgary.
That is a simple question, Jim, but hard, if that makes sense. I don't think I've, you know, I guess I've been asked that, but I in simplest terms, obviously, I said it earlier, the game has evolved immensely as right. far as now it's all about. These kids are wizards with the puck and their stick handling ability, and certainly Russ had that kind of quality, so he would have fit in today's game, I think, easily. But I think... from the standpoint, it's changed. I would say for any young kid, certainly skating, edge work. You have to be able to move. You have to be mobile. Doesn't matter what position you play, and handle the puck so that it's on a string. I mean, that's what it's about. That's what the game's about. Obviously, the hockey IQ term we use a lot. But for me, back when I was playing, I mean, you'd better want to work harder than the next guy. You'd better believe in yourself. And that's what I always still tell young kids, if you have any self-doubt, forget it. You don't have a chance, because there's going to be people knocking you right. down. And I know, and I always remember this. I was in Edmonton after I was drafted 18th overall, and certain things stick out and you always remember. And I went to a rink in the summer where everybody in the, you know, guys that are drafted play in, you know, to get ready for camp and get in shape and play in scrimmage and stuff. And I remember being on the bench, and I remember guys not thinking, I heard them, and a couple guys went, I can't believe he went 18th overall. He's not that good.
Oh, you know?
And Jesus, of course, we're all sensitive. It's stung. I'm 18. And then you go, am I really that good? And, you know, and I'd go home, and I was a little down, and I had an older brother who was very supportive. And my brother goes, you're nuts, Kenny. So you better damn well believe in yourself, you know. And they took you at 18 for a reason. Don't listen to some guy say that you're not good enough, you're not going to make it, whatever it may be. So it sounds easy, it sounds simple, and we use that term a lot, but you're believing in yourself, working harder than the next guy. And that was something I made sure I did. I knew I might not have the most skill, but I better be the hardest working guy out there. And I had a passion for a game and love. If you don't have the passion and love, there's no way you can get to an elite level, I don't think. But, and that's the reason, again, going back to your first question of why I played so long, that was the only reason. I mean, I wouldn't have half the talent of a lot of guys that played in the league, but I wasn't going to take no for an answer. I was going to do whatever it took to help my team win in any way. And obviously I'm grateful and thankful that Lou Lamoriello, who was my boss for a long, long time, believed in that too. And he believed I brought something that was going to help the team.
Well said. Well said. And when you were told you were a drummer, you listened.
I listened. Yeah.
And you know, back to what you were talking about players coming and going, you hit it right on the head. There were so many good players, quality players that came in and had a chip on their shoulder, which you need, mm-hmm. but then they wouldn't adjust. When I got traded from Toronto to Montreal, I was a centerman, and Pat Burns goes, you're going to play right wing. And if I had have said in that moment, fuck no, I would have probably, that would have been it. I would have got buried because I'd just been traded, but I sucked it up and I learned a new position. I ended up playing longer as a right winger than I did as a centerman, but less about me. There's so many players we saw that came through the door that could have, if they just did what they were asked instead of what they thought, And with the effort and determination of a guy like Kenny, there would have been a lot of different names from our era that would have played, because there was a hell of a lot of good hockey players that just got buried because they weren't willing to change, or they couldn't, or they just couldn't, you know, a guy just couldn't be a good two-way player. And Guy Carboneau is a great example. He was like 180-point junior centerman. And they took him aside in Montreal and they said, we've got a position here for a defensive two-way centerman, and you're offensive. So if you can't do it, then we'll trade you. And he said, no, I want to be a Montreal Canadian. And he became a Hall of Fame defensive player. And I played with him, and fuck, when we got the puck, man, he was all like, he thought like an offensive minded player. And that's why I had my career years playing with him.
That is one of the best examples for us, is Guy Carboneau, because he was, you're absolutely right. I mean, 180 point guy in junior. So when you go to the National Hockey League, well, you just can't freewheel and do whatever you want because you were so skilled in junior. We got a role here for you. No, it doesn't mean you can't score and chip in, which he did, and went on to a Hall of Fame career that you mentioned, Russ. But that is a prime example of kind of exactly what I was saying prior, as far as understanding a role, because so many guys, if you can't find that role in the National Hockey League, you just don't stay around as long, because we can't translate, a lot of us, what we can do. I wanted to be Scott Niedermayer. I would have loved to be Scott Niedermayer. I didn't have Scott Niedermayer's legs, you know, so that's the way it is. But it sounds simplistic, but to drive it home in your head that, well, I've got to just do my part and help the team win, or else I'm not going to be around, because when I do too much, that takes away from what I'm good at, or how I'm helping the team win along the way.
Right. And Kenny, you became excellent at that role too. I mean, I played against you for 16 years. So I know, I saw, I witnessed, and you became excellent at that position, and be proud of it. And so many people who don't accept that role, they feel like they're slighted or they're undermined, and you didn't, and congratulations to you, because you did it well, and won cups for it, fucker. And but anyways, I'm so sorry for knocking your teeth out.
Like I said, hey, obviously I forgot, because I wasn't sure if it was Jeff or you.
Fuck, I should have went with Jeff.
But Kenny, we can't talk about this thing. We can't leave this subject. So not only were you told about your role as a drummer, that's a great analogy that Lamoriello gave you, but fighting. Okay. You also lasted 20 years as a fighter in the NHL. And when was that point that you realized, Kenny, you were going to have to fight? I don't know. Like you played in Saskatchewan and junior and Seattle and all these places in the minors. But you were one of the best fighters ever, man, to lace them up. Did you like that role?
Wow. I'm not going to go that far, but I will say, Jim, and thank you. I will say I can handle myself, but boy, let me tell you, it could be very nerve wracking going into certain games, but I really only had to do it. The majority of my fighting majors and penalty minutes were in the first 5-7 years of my career. And you make a little room for yourself, and then you get younger guys, bigger, stronger, that fill that role for you, especially when the game was played like that, like Russ knew, that the fourth liners or your 6-7 defensemen, a lot of times that was the game. You were a bruiser. You were a fighter. You were a guy that handled that aspect of the game. Intimidation was a big part of the game. So the first 5 years, I was never going to back down. I was never going to show that I was fearful at times. And we all are, trust me. But I wanted to make a name for myself. I wanted to get my foot in the door. And I know that's how I was going to get noticed as well. I know I went in the first round, so I had a little bit of skill, obviously. But a lot of first rounders were tough too. And that was part of the reason I went where I went. Was when I came in, I knew I was going to have to go into Philadelphia. And I tell you, when we drove that bus in the early 80s down to Philadelphia, you could hear from down the New Jersey Turnpike, because it was about an hour and a half away, you could hear a pin drop on our bus going, I just want to get out of here alive. I would go look at their lineup and I go, Dave Brown, Glenn Cochran, Craig Berube, Daryl Stanley, Rick Tockett, a young froth in retirement, going, I'm going, pick my poison, because I have to fight one of them.
Oh, man.
It's going to be no
fight. Oh, I'd hate that. I would hate that.
But, you know, And then
Fuck, were they tough? Fuck, yeah,
were they tough? So here's I could go on, but Jimmy, no. So that was the first five years. I had to do it a lot more to make some room for myself. I won some, I lost some. As long as I showed up, stuck up for teammates, that was an important factor, and that's what I was going to do, and stuck up for the team, and it was noticed by Lou Lamoriello. It was noticed by a lot of the upper echelon in the organization that this kid cares. He wants to help this team in any way he can, and that's when we weren't very good. So we used to go down that turnpike, and I think all we had was me and Joe Sorella at the time, and he was a pretty tough kid, and Joey was a heck of a player, and me and Joey would be sitting in the back of the bus and going, oh, Joe, which one do you want tonight? You know, who? You know, we did have some younger, like Mel Bridgman was getting a little older, and Ivan Vitura could fight. Those guys were experienced guys, but, you know, they expected the young guys to do it, just like I did when I when I got a little older and was able to develop my game a little bit, where I only had to do it 2, 3, 4 times a year after that. But we went down there. So Lou Lamoriello comes in 88. And we got pushed around a lot, not just not winning games, but that aspect of the game. And you know, the Flyers would abuse us and a lot of other teams, the Capitals. So Lou comes in. We have a big dinner. Everybody in camp, all 60 players. And our owner, the late, great John McMullen, who was like a second father to me, just treated me like gold. And because I was his first pick and a guy that he was as loyal as hell to me and probably to a fault. But he goes... He says, yep. He says, we've got a new general manager. We've got a new philosophy that he's going to bring in some guys that, so poor Kenny Danico doesn't have to go into Philadelphia and get his head kicked in every night. Swear to God, I didn't, and I barely said anything to the owner at the time. I didn't even know him that well, but I didn't know he thought that way. And then my first thought is, I didn't lose them all, Doc. His name was Doc. But his point was we were getting abused, and I was standing up to it. Yeah. And Lou Lamoriello comes in, and then he adds a young Troy Crowder and brings in Jim Korn and Dave Mailey. Well, I will tell you, that first bus trip to Philadelphia, there was hooting, there was hollering. We were ready to go into Philadelphia. Now I was the fifth toughest guy in the lineup. And I was feeling pretty comfortable going, yes, I get to go down the ladder as far as the tough guys on the Philadelphia Flyers, because that's when a young froth and Troy Crowder was coming in, and he was mopping up the league a little bit there. And I'm going, oh, I feel a lot better.
That's so good.
Oh, that's funny, man. Plus there was Semenk and Kordick and Marty McSorley and Kosher and Jimmy Kite and all those guys back
you,
then.
You name it. I fought them all once. A lot of times it was just once.
Kenny, did you fight Wendell Clark his first year in the league?
I probably got the greatest story for you ever there, too. As you mentioned, Wendell Clark. Lou doesn't like when I tell this one, I don't think. But I can get it out there now. I think I've told it once. So, because nobody does this anymore. So... we go into Toronto. Wendell Clark is one of the best fighters I've ever seen. He was just tough as nails.
Yeah.
And he elbows Claude Loisel in the head. This is Lou's
first year. I remember this.
This is Lou's first year. Elbows him in the head. No call. That was all part of clean hitting. I jump on the ice, challenge Clark right at Swenner Ice. Wasn't much of a fight. We got into a couple punches. I wrestled into the ice. It was over, you know. And I knew Wendell. I roomed with his brother in the Saskatchewan Junior League, Don Clark, and he passed, God bless his soul, too young. But he really looked after me in Yorkton when I was a Yorkton Terrier. And Don Clark, that was like, that league was like Slapshot, the Saskatchewan Junior League. So that's kind of where I learned my toughness. I had to survive. I was 15 years old in the league. Well, one of two 15-year-olds, and Don Clark taught me a little bit. So I kind of knew Wendell as a kid, but knew I might have to scramble. But it was natural. He elbowed my teammate in the head. I went after him. Wasn't much of a fight. It was over, and it's still on YouTube, I think. But after the game, I go change into my suit. Walk out, Lou Lamoriello, who was trying to just get acclimated to the team. We didn't know much about Lou at the time, but he had that presence, that leadership ability. Shakes my hand, and there's three $100 bills in his hand. And I go, what the hell is this for? He says, go out, get yourself something, have a nice meal. I love what you did tonight. I go, never did it again. Never. He just, well, I go, Lou, that's part of my role. I don't need this. That's, he says, just take it, go, you know, do whatever you need to do, you know, get yourself a
suit. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, whatever it was. He never did it again. That was, and this wasn't about paying to fight or that had nothing to do with it. It was all about him wanting to relay to his team, we got to stick together. And that's the way the game was played back then. And Claude Loisel got elbowed. And Russ, you say you were playing in that game, I believe, yeah. Probably.
Clarkie was my line mate. And I guarantee you that $300 was spent at Pat and Mario's, yeah, at the bottom of Church Street.
Probably, but like I said, moral story, it was nothing to do with the fighting. There, it was about Lou Shaw saying you're going to be there for your team and a teammate. And I was shocked. I knew what Lou was all about right away. And like I said, he never did that again. That was just to make sure he wanted to embrace you and tell you that you're part of something. You're part of the team, and you did something that this team's been pushed around for years. You know what I mean? Kind of attitude.
Hey, Kenny, at the end of my career, so I finished 99, my last few years, we were all, if you got traded, you played your opposing team that traded you, guys were putting up like 100 for a game-winning goal or 100 for a shutout. And fuck, by the end, there's like $1,200 on the board. You know, the coach is putting money up and like you physically tape it on the whiteboard and put GW underneath it or game winning assist or biggest hit. And then guys would add to it. And it was so much fun. And Bob Gainey walked in once and he put $200 up and he said for the game winning goal maybe a shutout or something. And the boys just went nuts. It was so much fun. And guys were making a lot of money. They started to make a lot of money back then in the late 90s. Yeah. And that kind of stuff goes a long way. And I think I've said this before. I don't care who you are, Kenny. Everybody wants a pat on the back, whether you're Wayne Gretzky or the worst player in the league. When your GM or coach comes up and slaps you on the back and goes, attaboy, I like the way you're playing or you're working hard, it means the frickin' world to a player. And I don't care who it is, because everybody wants to be appreciated. And so many fucking times that we did what we did and no one said anything. And you're like wondering what's going on, you know, am I? And for him to do that, I mean, that's just a freaking awesome, awesome move on his part.
You nailed it, Russ. And I tell you, and now more so today, you have to be a psychologist as a coach. Who needs a hug? Who needs a pat in the back, even if they're playing back? Yeah. Or who needs a kick in the butt? Because you got to know your personalities. Obviously, the old days where, and I didn't always believe with the old school mentality, but that's the way it was. They were always hard on you, all these old school coaches. And that was okay. That was our time. But it wasn't about the money Lou was handing me. I was almost in tears when actually we had that handshake. And I remember like it was yesterday going, this frigging guy, you know, really appreciates what I'm going to bring to this team. And no, I wasn't the guy that was going to score the game winning goal or do, you know, make the big play offensively. He's just showing my little part counts. It matters. Yeah. That didn't mean I had to go fight every night. He wasn't telling me to go fight every night. It was just about the respect. And he was showing me that, Kenny, everything you do, it adds up to this team. And I was, like I said, not about the money he gave me. It was about the appreciation he was giving me on that particular night. I was almost in tears, for sure.
Hey, and the reason why Wendell laid that kid out was because he slashed me and said, yeah, and he said something to me. I can't remember what he was chirping me, and Clarkie on the bench goes, watch this.
Yeah, well, Cody Loisel could do that. He was a good player. He could get under your skin.
He loved to talk.
Kenny, one of your, with all these great roles that you play, good God, you know, I got you on the show. I'm so revved up right now, how motivating you are. I'm going to go fucking try out for the NHL, Rusty, tomorrow.
I'm going to call Bill and tell him we got a new host.
Yeah. Can you come on every week, Kenny?
When my team struggles, I want to jump out of the booth and help them. I just want their success. And then I realize I'm 57. My heart says I can still do it. The legs obviously beg to differ. And even talking to you guys and getting fired up, I'm winded. So, come back is out.
So one of your greatest days, Kenny, I think, and I was a battler. I'm a clean and sober guy now for many years. And God, those were some dark days.
Fun at first, and then it got dark. Yeah, yeah. I don't regret some of that stuff. We had a blast, but I'm certainly glad where I am today.
Yeah, we had some fun. But I think, Kenny, you were the first guy when the NHL said, we got to help guys with this. Mm-hmm. I think you were one of the first guys to go into the NHL's substance abuse program. Mm-hmm. Is that sound right?
Yeah, and I still talk to a guy, Dan, from the program who's still involved with it. And this is back in the early days. And he tells me I was fifth on the chart. The other four did it privately because you didn't have to go public. Well, I went away in 97 during the season. It was the first 6 weeks of the season. And actually, I was playing really good hockey, playing great. And that's when I knew something was going on in my life, Jimmy. So I was the first guy to go public in the NHL, NHLPA, substance abuse behavioral program, whatever they call it. But it was great. And look, I didn't agree with everything back then, how they went about it. But I had such a, and thank God for Lou Lamoriello and John McMullen, our late great owner that I talked about. Because I'd played a long time already, and it was 97, and you're always worried about your career and how's it going to look. And, you know, I can't do this during the season. I can hold it off. Well, things are going well, but I was, you know, drinking too much and partying too much. And I, you know, Lou knew all along the whole story, and he'd had me in his office many times. And I'd curb it up. I'd curb my nightlife because my game was so important to me. The Devils were so important to me. So I'd balance it, you know, to the best of my ability. But it got to the point where it became dark days. I'm feeling depressed. I'm feeling down. And that's when I went into Lou and said, Lou, you know, I got a problem. And he kind of looked at me like, duh, you know. But right. I don't know how he wanted to say, I don't know how you managed it this long. You know what I mean? Because I would pull up my bootstrings and I'd stop for 3 months solid, cold turkey, and just focus on the game. But, you know, it was just how I felt about myself. And finally, 97, and I was playing good. During this, it was in November, and I said, Lou, I got to do something about this because I got to take away the most important thing in my life right now, and that's my game, my daughter, who I just had as well. And I said, I don't want to let any more people down. More importantly, I don't want to let myself down, and I got to check this out. You know, you still don't believe it. You don't believe I can manage it. You think, consider yourself weak or whatever it may be, and you know, now this isn't a problem. It's not a disease. How can this thing have a hold of me, you know what I mean? Addiction. Mm-hmm. But sure enough, I went in and Lou says, Kenny, we're going to be here for you, man. I go ahead. And then the next day, we call the league or the program, and they'd already known about it and everything because I'd behind closed doors done some work with them. And then the next day I had second thoughts. It just hit me. I'm going, oh no. So I go, yeah. Lou, sure, maybe I can get through the season. Lou and Dr. Mullen, the owner, were, no, absolutely, you're going now. And I said, but. And then finally they convinced me for sure. This is the best thing for you. You're not losing your job. You know, I know a lot of teams would have treated me like a piece of meat and moved forward. But because of that loyalty over the years and what I brought to the organization, they weren't going to give up on me. And sure enough, went away for about 3 months. It wasn't just a month like everybody thinks. It was however long it was going to take to get me right. And certainly was the greatest decision of my life. Now, that just planted seeds. I stayed sober for almost 2 years at the time, but mm-hmm. went back because, like I said, there's rarely a first-time winner. But right. It certainly was a stepping stone to getting sober, and I've been sober for 10 years last August 9th when my wife threw a big party. It was probably my best party ever. Sobriety party. I she brought friends over and threw a surprise 10th anniversary party. So I go, hon, you didn't. There was all kinds of cars. She goes, Kenny, this is better than anything else you've accomplished. You know what I mean? And I said, well, it's nothing I did. I said, thank the big guy upstairs and thanks to people that supported me and believed in me, because I was at the point where I'm going, when I went back, Jim, after my career and went on a few benders, I'm going, I got one foot in. I'm not having fun with it. I'm not having fun without it. I couldn't get comfortable in my own skin But that 97 was instrumental because of the Devils organization being so supportive and planting those seeds. And yeah, I stayed sober then. I didn't stay sober right up till this day, but it took my banging my head against the wall a little longer, and thank God got it after that. But the league was a tremendous help to me, and I know they give a lot of guys help. And you could do it quietly, you could do it in the open, but the only way for me at that time was to be the first guy that goes public. And we didn't even tell anybody. The papers in the loose said he's on a leave of absence until I got back. You know what I mean? At the time. And it was great. Like I said, that planted the seeds. But, man, it took me banging my head against the wall a little bit more, because after my career, I didn't have to be in shape. I didn't have to focus. That kept me in line. And afterwards, it was like, yeah, now let the party begin again. And certainly, and I don't mean to ramble on, but you know what? It's something that's real important to me. Because you know what? I can't believe the emails after that I got from mother's kids, 18-year-old, 19-year-old kids going, they can't believe, like, we're human. We have the same problems you do, you know, whatever it may be. That if I help one person that said my kid, I got convinced him to go into rehab or get help, whatever it may be, because he heard your story and he was a hockey fan and he respected you, or a Devils fan, or whatever it may be. It blew me away how many people you touch by telling your story and by, you know, saying that, no, it wasn't easy, but I'm on the right path now and I love my life. And I'm still crazy, as you guys see, and nuts. I just don't need a drink anymore. And thank God for that, because I don't think I'd be here today if I didn't stop.
Congratulations, and keep telling your story, because it really is important for people like yourself to talk about it. My Jeff and I we raise money for mental health. Our dad committed suicide, and we kept that a secret for a long, long time. And Jimmy's been a big part of helping us with our cause. And when we came out and told the story and told people how it affected them, in such a positive way, because then they could tell their story. I always tell people, it's kind of like a homosexual coming out of the closet and admitting to that they're gay. When you tell your story, it allows other people to go, oh my God, Kenny Danico is as normal as I am, or my father, or my mother, or my sister, whatever. And same with mental health. It's just so important. And I got one question for you. In 97, did you go through your therapy here in LA?
I did.
So you and I skated together. I was waiting. I hadn't been signed yet, and you were out here, and we skated with all those celebrities, the Hollywood elites and actors and stuff. And you were there. You were really quiet.
They allowed me to get out a little bit and skate, but, and try to stay in shape. Yeah.
So it was you, Alexander Mogilny, and myself were the only three guys who weren't playing and in the NHL, because the season had started. So we were skating, and I swear to God, one of our friends, I think Brian Turner, somebody knew that you were in for rehab, and nobody talked about it. It was very private. And I knew that you were out there for it, but I thought the reason why you didn't talk to me in the locker room was because I knocked your teeth out.
You know what, Russ?
I swear to God, you didn't look at me, you didn't talk to me, and I was like, oh, fuck, he's still mad.
No, still, you know what, and I commend you and your brother, because I've heard a little bit about your story and mental health and helping others. And it's amazing, because you know why I was probably so quiet, and now people say, if you give me a mic, you can't take it out of my hand now. And you guys are seeing that, but if it's because I'm embarrassed. You're embarrassed for what you're going through. You feel down. It's so hard, and you're absolutely right. Now you share your story, whether it's about mental health and what you and your brother went through with your father, or me having to go to rehab. And it wasn't just one, it was a couple, even after my career is over, till I finally got it right. But it's an experience where you go, you're ashamed. I was ashamed. Something's got a hold of me. No, I'm too strong. I'm too powerful. How does this have a hold of me? And I was embarrassed by it for sure. So I'm like, hope nobody knows I'm in rehab. Hope nobody knows.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. We knew, and we just, you know, typical hockey players, right? We respect the shit out of each other, even when we don't like each other, and when we're competitors. But you put hockey players in a room together, especially after, I mean, we all like each other pretty much. Like there's probably one asshole on every team, but for the most part, hockey players really, really are good guys who get along and respect one another because we know what the fuck we've been through and we know what we know what others have been through. But obviously what you were going through, Alexander and I, McGillney, we knew, and
I played with Alex and won a cup with him in 2000.
What a fucking great guy.
Yeah.
Can't believe he's not in the Hall of Fame yet.
Yes, he will be in. He's got to be in eventually. But he was, when he got traded to us, Russ, every story leads to another story. But he got traded 2000 to us. Lou Lamoriello, what a coup he made and a great trade at the time. He always had the pulse of our team. And we needed one more dynamic type player. And we'd heard him coming from, you know, where there was in Vancouver, Buffalo, he was Mr. Everything. He had all that pressure on him to be the guy. And everybody says, well, he's not going to be fit in very well with you guys, this team mentality. And I'm going, so I remember when he came to the Devils and a few of us just got around him and said, hey, Alex, guess what? You don't have to be the man here. All you have to do is go out and use your skill and ability and score a big goal here and there. It was like the weight of the world was off. Like, really? He loved it. And by the way, we don't win without him because he was that guy that in practice made me better because he was so freaking skilled. It was a joke. But he loved it. So he fit in perfectly because he was that guy going, he had that. I didn't realize all that pressure he had on him night in, night out to carry an organization. And when he came to New Jersey, he said, Alex, we're about winning and winning cups. Chip in here and there. You can go 10 games without a goal. It's okay here.
what a player. I mean, man, that guy made Kirk McLean go freaking crazy in practice because he just go in and score on him every freaking time. And Kirk was like, can you shoot at the other fucking goalie at the other end? Like, leave me alone. And the only thing, so I think Alexander was better than Pavel Bure. Pavel Bure was more exciting. But I think that Alexander was a better player. But the only thing Mo couldn't do was skate backwards. Did you ever see him?
Come on.
I swear to God, he couldn't skate backwards.
A guy couldn't skate backwards.
He looked like a guy at public skating, you know, up bobbing up and down. It was hilarious. Yeah, he couldn't skate backwards.
So we talk about Russ, the skill today and all these young kids, because fourth liners can toe drag now. They couldn't do it back in our day or that sharp cut back and the great edge work and the speed. McGillney almost made me break my ankle a couple times in practice. So I know what Kirk McLean was feeling. I'm going, this son of a, you know what? I'm going, and I was pretty good defensively, and I was always in position, stick in front, and he'd cut back or put it between my stick and skates, and I'd trip over myself, and I'd go, I actually wanted to kill him a few times. I'm going, Alex, okay. But man, did he make enough, enough already. But he made me better. He made me a better player even later in my career because you learn that gap and certainly how to play star-type players like a McGillney. But he was – I loved when he came to us.
I'm glad to hear you say great things about him because I'm constantly talking about him. And
right.
A guy like Neil Broughton, I think, should be in the Hall of Fame. I don't understand it. I mean, he was that good. McGillney, you know, they've loosened up the door is a little bigger now to get into the Hall of Fame for players than, you know, 20, 30 years ago. And those guys definitely deserve to be in with the other players that are in now.
I couldn't agree with you more. Fortunate enough to play with both those guys, Russ. And,
That Kevin Lowe's in, you got a shot.
Kevin's our buddy. Jimmy's in mine, so I'm very happy for Kevin Lowe because you know what? Look, who am I to judge criteria, whatever it may be? Having said that, when you compare certain players, whether it's a McGillney to somebody or a Broughton, well, you know what? We believe they are because we played with them. I played with Neil Broughton 95. We don't win a cup without him. We don't win a cup without McGillney in 2000 and the great career he had and the 76 goals in one season, all those great offensive statistics. But it's not just that. He was a game changer, an all-world player. I agree with you, Russ. And so, like I said, who am I to judge? I was happy for Kevin because I know what he meant to the Edmonton Oilers because I was around it, right, Jim? Yeah. We're around those guys, and I know how important a piece he was. So I was grateful to see a guy like Kevin Lowe get in the appreciation for the unsung hero type player. It's Bingo. Not just about numbers all the time. Right?
Bingo. Yeah. You're bang on. Why not put the best of the best in the Hall of Fame, whatever position that might be?
Sometimes maybe it's just too much about numbers. But having said that, like I said, I can't imagine it being easy making those decisions.
Right. Kenny, I love you. I love you, man. I can't believe what I, you know, I always say, well, if we can get a good half hour out of our guest. Okay, well,
I never forewarned you, Jimmy, that unfortunately, even my wife says to me, she says, Kenny, you tell me 30 minutes and you're on for an hour and 45, they probably want you off.
No, man.
It's the only time I get to talk hockey and life. And so it's therapy for me as well.
You're a remarkable guy, Kenny. You really are a remarkable guy. I've known you a long time, and miles don't end friendships, with this thing. But
absolutely.
What a great story. What an awesome hockey career. What an awesome broadcasting career. And of course, ending it off with the way you're helping young guys, that, you know, the world's a better place, Danny, Dano, with you around. And I really appreciate your how candid you were in the show, man. It was just, I'm motivated. I don't know what I'm motivated to do, but it's something. It's something. Okay.
I will say, Jim and Russ, great being on with you guys. And like I said, it's therapy for me. Every once in a while, I go on a podcast here and there, and I just love talking the game, life, the ups, the downs, the in-betweens, and I had plenty of them. And yes, if we can do our little part to help one person, whatever it may be or you have experience with, I think it does make the world a better place. And Russ, even the mental health, fantastic. And Jimmy, I know you've been sober. We talked about that way back, didn't we? About the sobriety thing. And
yeah.
So we've come full circle, baby. We did have some fun in the early 80s, though.
Yeah, we sure did.
We know one thing. You guys weren't talking about it at 7:30 a.m. when Paul Messier picked you guys up.
Hey, Jimmy, he did.
I'm just grateful we both grew up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I call them the blurry days, Kenny. I call them the blurry days, but God, thanks. Would you come on again, Kenny? Our show,
anytime, guys. It was a real pleasure.
Okay, next week and every week after that. Take it easy, Kenny. Yeah,
thanks for coming on, Kenny.
Pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me. See you later.
Thanks for being with us. Please be sure to subscribe to the Suspendables today and share the show with your friends and followers. And find out everything you need to know about the show on our brand new website, thesuspendables.com.